What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. And as we continue our season on Justice Warriors, I have a really unique and interesting guest today. I'm joined today by Heather Lewis, who is the executive director of the Reuniting Family Bail Fund and works as a national participatory defense trainer, which she's going to explain to me and all of you here in a few minutes. She's out of, is it Philadelphia, Pennsylvania? Is that right?
Montgomery County. We're neighboring county to Philadelphia.
Okay. Well, Heather, welcome to the show. And before we get into what all this stuff is, when I was reading up, preparing to chat with you today, and this is, by the way, one of my favorite parts of the season. Anytime I'm interested in something, I just get to bring them on and just talk to them and learn about
it.
And I saw you have a master's degree in, is it human relations?
Human
is
services.
That what your degree?
Human services. Yes.
So how, before we get into like what these programs are that you're involved in and how it can relate to the work that we do and how people can help, can you kind of give me kind of your origin story? Like, how did you become involved in criminal justice reform to begin with?
Absolutely. And thank you, Bob, for being interested in this topic and being a justice warrior and all of those things that we're even able to have this conversation. So I appreciate you and all the work that you're doing. My origin story is interesting because I did not intend to do this work. I did not think, oh, let me, you know, be this justice oriented, you know, nonprofit professional, right? I've been a nonprofit professional for over 20 years, but I think it's in my DNA. I'm just naturally a servant of my community, my family. And, you know, just watching my grandmother as I was growing up, she was the first woman, let alone Black woman, to be the president of a VFW. And so Ambler is my home VFW. And so just watching her be such an advocate for our community, you know, making sure, you know, our neighbors had what they needed, having food drives and toy drives for the kids and clothing drives. She just always had, you know, our hand in all of these things and making sure that there were resources for folks that needed it. And so I find myself now as an adult, you know, doing those same things. So my career path went through a bunch of different things. I'm a retired hairstylist. So even in that profession, when I was a hairstylist for 18 years, I was running the community events. You know, we had Earth Day and I was doing that. And we were partnering with, you know, women's domestic violence shelters and giving free haircuts. So I was always organizing the community and making sure that, you know, the folks that are in need were able to get some of those humanizing resources that they needed in a way that was exactly that, humanizing, not, you know, oh, I'm doing this for you. What are we going to, you know, this quid pro quo type of situation. So was always doing that. And then was inspired to start my own nonprofit. And this was, again, 20 years ago, where I was working with young people, at-risk youth, and trying to, you know, teen pregnancy was rampant. I was a teen mom. And wanted to help young people make better choices despite whatever their home situation was or school life and try to balance that. And I was a youth advocate for a domestic violence organization. And so really working with the youth. But then I started getting trained by the executive director, going to meetings and understanding grant writing and understanding how to develop programs and things like that. And I was a writer naturally. And so I know the nonprofit landscape of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania very well. Okay. And so that's kind of how I got started. So I bounced around with a couple of different nonprofits with fair housing work. So I was education and outreach coordinator for fair housing. So I understood, you know, now housing justice, you know, so I got experience in that realm and then went on to a community action agency, which has an umbrella of resources and programs. In particular, there was a fatherhood program, which worked with men that were coming home from incarceration, getting them connected with their children and employment and whatever it is that they needed to get, you know, have a running start, you know, once they came home from incarceration. And that's where we met Raj Jayadev, who is the founder of Participatory Defense. They're out of Silicon Valley, California. Their organization is called Debug. And so our chief public defender at the time was Keir Bradford Gregg. And she met Raj in California at a convention, heard him speak and said, I need that in my community. She was very much a community advocate, very much wanting community to be involved in the criminal legal system and understanding and being aware of what's actually happening in the courtrooms. And so Participatory Defense was exactly that. And so she brought Raj out to Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. They had, you know, a conference and, you know, everyone got to hear and see him speak and learn about what the program was. And out of 90 organizations that were in attendance, only one organization took up the call to bring Participatory Defense to Montgomery County. And that was a community action agency that we were that I was working with at the time. And that was 11 years ago this month. So we have been practitioners of Participatory Defense for 11 years. And again, I was like the grant writer, program developer, designer. Mm-hmm. And so my job then was now, how do we find funding? How do we just, you know, create this program? How do we make it work? And to show that this was 11 years ago, this is way before Zoom, we were Skyping with California to kind of get the training and do all this. We were still building the training models and how, you know, how do we share this with other communities? How do we bring other trainers on board? So we're at the very beginning of this model becoming a national model. So it was just a very interesting time. And like I said, I did not, you know, set out to say, hey, I want to be, you know, in this arena. I just knew that this was important. I wasn't a directly impacted person at the time either. Directly impacted, meaning I did not have a loved one that was incarcerated or had gotten arrested or had a criminal history at that time. But shortly thereafter, my son, you know, caught a case. And now here we are doing Participatory Defense to get the best outcome for my son. And so I can go on and on. So if you got questions, please stop me and you know, anywhere along the way.
Big thing, you know, I did some reading about Participatory Defense, and it seems that, you know, it is with the family and community being involved in pretrial and court proceedings. But if you can kind of really, you can define it obviously far better than I can, because it's not a term I, you know, I've worked in this realm for a long time, and it's not a term I'm familiar with. And I think that most of my audience probably isn't either. So if you can kind of like, what is participatory defense?
Absolutely. And thank you. Participatory defense is a grassroots organizing model to bring community, to balance the power in the courtroom, right? The criminal legal system is designed to isolate, to intimidate, to have the power be in the defense attorney, the power to be with the DA's or the ADA's office, the power to be with the judge, the, you know, the police departments, all the actors of the legal system, right? They're the experts. They hold all of the power because they hold all of the knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And so what participatory defense does is makes an attempt to balance that power by giving knowledge to communities. And so my son, I'll use my son's story as an example. And mind you, I was already a practitioner for about 2 years. What it does is it tells me what to expect in the process. So from arrest, there's different points of intervention where a participatory defense hub could come and support a family and even post-conviction. So after a loved one is convicted, we can still work with them to understand the process. None of us are attorneys. So we have relationships with attorneys and things like that. But in our hub meetings, it's really just families that are directly impacted and understanding the process. We're not giving legal advice. We're not, you know, determining guilt or innocence. That's really not our goal. Our goal is recognizing that this is an historically racist, oppressive system designed to really, you know, tear families apart. And our goal is to get the best outcome possible for that family. And so we strategize with family. So the more they understand, the more they can better communicate with their attorney, whether it's a public defender or, you know, a paid attorney. Their job is to do as little as they can, right? To get whatever outcome they think is acceptable to you and to get as much money as they can, right? And with as little sweat equity. So they don't have to do as much because it's like, okay, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And you being a layperson, not understanding, you being completely frustrated, you know, anxieties on 1,000, what's happening to my children? What's happening to my home? How am I going to navigate this process? I don't have any money. You know what I mean? I just want to go home, right? All of those things are going through your head. So it's really hard to think and process when an attorney who you're supposed to trust, you're right, because that's how they're presented. They're lawyers. They have all this knowledge. They understand the law. They know the process, which they do, but they also know all the shortcuts that they can do to not necessarily get you the best outcome, but it's going to expedite their process to get you off of their caseload, right? And so what we do in attempt to again, balance the power is infuse knowledge into the families where they now can slow down that process and ask pertinent questions. What's a Rule 600? When do we qualify for a Rule 600? What can we ask for when we are applying for a Rule 600? You know, can I get a bail reduction hearing? Can I have my own experts? Can I need to have my full discovery. How do I get my full discovery? You know, because with COVID, everything has changed, right? How they deliver information, you know, the availability of a CO to, you know, facilitate a visit, all of that has changed. And so we've helping families navigate that system. Again, like I said, we're not attorneys. We're not saying, you know, we can pick up a law, you know, we can Google the statute for a crime, right? Anybody can do that and say, okay, well, this crime carries a sentence from 2 to 4 years. So if they're offering you a deal for, you know, a 6 to 12, you're like, wait a minute, pause. What is that? Have you gotten your full discovery? Do you even know the evidence that they have against you? And most people will say no. And it's like, how can you accept a plea deal? You don't even know what they have against you as far as evidence.
Is that a big part of participatory defense? Because one of the biggest problems I see in our system, and I've said it many, many times, it's such an assembly line, you know, 90 some percent of cases get pled out. It's like it's all about negotiations. Very rarely does anything go to trial. Does this model help kind of like pump the brakes on that for a minute and make sure? Because we hear it all the time. I have people that I've worked with who are wrongfully convicted that are in a real bind because they ended up pleading guilty. Because they were facing the death penalty or they were facing life. Yeah. And they're like, well, we'll give you 20 years. Yeah. And so they'll take these plea deals. And I hear everything that you're talking about right now, right? Like they didn't know. They just felt like everything was happening fast. Their attorney's telling them to do it. They don't know, you know, they don't know what the real situation is. And when their attorney says, look, you go to trial, you're going to lose. You better just take it. And they take it. And then it's a 20, 30 year battle that's very infrequently successful to try to undo that.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it is. And when you mentioned, you know, the felony murder rule, which actually, I'm not sure, where are you in Pennsylvania, Bob?
I'm in Michigan.
Michigan. Okay. So in Pennsylvania, they're just now overturning, I'm not exactly sure where they're at in legislation, but they're challenging the felony murder law. And which that means, like you say, me and you, Bob, we're out, we're going to dinner. And you see an ex that you can't stand and you just skirt and you run this lady over and you kill her. We're in the car together. I'm subject to felony murder, which is the second degree. And you were the driver. You did it. You take a deal, right? You get 25 years. I'm innocent. I don't even know the lady, but I'm facing the same charges that you are. I take it to trial. I'm found guilty. I get life in prison.
Right.
Because I don't take the deal because I don't know this lady. I didn't drive. It wasn't planned. Like all these things, but the system doesn't care.
Right.
They just be like, oh, we getting 2 for 1.
Yeah. In now Michigan, it's a little different here. You know, we have really strict aiding and abetting laws in Michigan, mm-hmm. which is, you know, essentially if you are part of, for example, I was actually on the jury for this case. This group of guys were going to go in and rob like a pawn shop or something. Mm-hmm. And the guy that drove was the guy whose trial I was on. So, you know, he's driving. These guys go in. They end up pulling out guns. They tie the guy up there. So they end up hitting with, like, you know, basically like kidnapping, unlawful restraint, firearms mm-hmm. charges, all these things.
Right.
And then he got charged with all, you know, he was involved in what happened, but it seemed like he didn't know that any of this was going to happen.
Right.
But so a guy who never touched a gun went mm-hmm. to prison on a firearms charge.
Right. Right. Exactly. And, you know, it's unfortunate because, like I said, you're innocent in certain things. And it's like, you don't even have that option. But you do, if you have the understanding that you do have these options. And most of the time, like you said, the lawyer will say, you're not going to beat this. You're not going to whatever. But I can say, all right, it's a negotiation. You got some leverage. Now I say, hey, yeah, I didn't have the firearm, but I did do this. So I'm willing to take the deal on this 3, 4, and 8, you know
right.
what I mean? Versus all 12 or whatever number of the charges. You know what I mean? So it's a negotiation tool. We're not against people taking plea deals, but understand what you're pleading to. And you do have the ability to negotiate your plea deal where it's like, okay, well, this is what the DA is offering. You take it or leave it. It's not that. Usually, you know, it's just like negotiating when you're at a flea market. You know,
right.
what are you willing to pay? What are they willing to accept? And you got to find a way to meet in the middle, right? And that's exactly the same situation when you're negotiating your plea deal. If you know, you did, you know, X, Y, and Z, then, you know, you cop to that, but I'm not doing that. So if you want to, we're going to have to work on that. And most defendants don't understand that because, like you said, They're fast tracking this thing. They don't want you to think. They're fast talking and you don't get the opportunity. We tell our families, don't you ever take a plea deal without reviewing your discovery. Because that's what, if you know, oh, I wasn't there, or you see holes like I didn't do this, or I was somewhere else when this was going on and you got the receipts for that. Yeah, bring it. Like, so the more knowledge that you have, the better negotiation position you're in to get the best outcome. And now that you say Michigan, there is a participatory defense hub, which I helped train, is in Racine.
I know right where that's at, yeah.
So I can connect you with our Racine folks. They are phenomenal. I mean, they have such a phenomenal skill set of people. And let me back up. With participatory defense, one of the, I hate to say requirements, but one of the pillars is that this is led by directly impacted people. So it's not like, you know, we can have an ex-attorney or an ex-DA start a hub and try to, you know, no, this is led by families that are directly impacted by the system. And so that Racine hub, oh my gosh, they are phenomenal. They have folks that have, you know, gone through some things and the laws in Michigan around, you know, the registry and all of that and how the parole office actually has more authority than the DA's office when it comes to, you know, bringing charges, because it's easier to violate somebody on parole than it is to bring new charges against someone. So the DA
right.
has kind of deferred to the parole office as a new, you know, initiating a charging agency. And I learned that when I was in Michigan. I was like, what the fuck? Like, this shit's
right.
it's wild. Michigan is wild. So that's what I love about being a trainer, because you go to different cities and different states and you realize, like, it's like, oh my gosh, am I glad to be in Pennsylvania? Do I want to move to Florida? Fuck no, I want to move to Florida. Like, you know what I mean? Not that I'm out here committing crimes, but shit happens. Life, a lot of the things that we experience with families is that they were in a life crisis and it just went left. You know what I mean? Because when you're in the moment, things happen and you're not necessarily thinking, and some people are just trying to survive. They're trying to survive being attacked and, you know, all these things happening, and they find themselves being charged with a crime. And it's like, you know, or mental health or substance abuse in particular here in Pennsylvania, Montgomery County in particular. That's what our jail has become, is a holding place for people that have substance abuse and mental health disorders. And it's mm-hmm. like, what's going on here? So one of the tools of participatory defense as a bail fund is being able to post bail for people. And on average, and I can send you all of our reports and our documents and things like that we've been done. doing over the last few years. But on average, I mean, our cap is $5,000 cash. So when you think about that, who is getting assigned cash bail at that level? The top three charges that we post for: retail theft, you know, small amounts of, you know, drug possession and paraphernalia, and simple assault. Those three go hand in hand with mental health and substance abuse. So we're literally sending our most vulnerable people with medical conditions, because substance abuse is a medical condition, right? Mental health is a medical condition. We are literally sending these people to jail on cash bail for a health crisis. You know, folks are stealing, you know, clothes or food or whatever the currency that they use to purchase their narcotics, right? That's what they're going to jail for. $2,500 for retail theft. Cash. No 10%. Straight cash. And it's like, these are people that are homeless. They're, you know, on disability. They, you know what I mean? They have no income. And our judges, when our report with the Vera Institute of Justice, just identified that over 800 arraignments that they watched, 0% of the time did an MDJ ask the defendant's ability to pay before they assigned a cash bail amount.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Why is it always chaos when we link up?
Because nobody plans anything, bro. Good thing the rug's ready like that.
For real. Rain, dirt, whatever. Available all-wheel drive, 5 modes, we still outside.
And they got some kick too. That turbo?
Torque is crazy. The most in its class. It moves.
Rogue doesn't mess around. And peep the space. Merch on merch, gear, mics, all of it fits.
Load up, we out.
2026 Nissan Rogue, built for all of it.
Auto Pacific segmentation, 2026 Rogue versus latest in-market competitors in the XSUV mainstream midsize class, excluding electrical vehicles, based on manufacturer websites.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So I want to dig into the cash bail a little bit, because there's a distinction there between mm-hmm. like being able to bond and bail. But before I do, I want to circle back to something, because for me, you know, when we work in wrongful convictions, mm-hmm. I'm always trying to identify, and that's partially why I had you come on the show today, because I'm always trying to identify, like, how do we fix the problem before it starts?
Right.
And something you said that had never really occurred to me that I think it's worth circling back to is when you talked about like using the participatory defense model to make sure they're informed, and particularly to get discovery before uh-huh. you. And when you said that, something just a kind of a light bulb clicked for me, how important that is. Because at that stage, especially if you have, you know, a public defender with a huge caseload, or even a private attorney with a huge caseload,
right?
When they're in that negotiating assembly line of trying just to plead out cases to avoid the trial, in all likelihood, your defense attorney has done zero investigation on your case at that point.
Correct.
Like the prosecutor said, this is what we got. This is mm-hmm. what we're going to get. You know, they're facing 10 to 20. We'll give you 5 and let's get out of here.
Yep.
So the important piece of this is that the defense attorney hasn't probably reviewed discovery very thoroughly. They haven't done any of their own investigation. And when you said, like, when you see the discovery, when you as a defendant are like, no, I want to see the discovery, and you see that's when you'll see, well, part of what they're saying, the evidence against me, is that they know I was here at this place at this time. And I can prove to you I wasn't at that place at that time.
Exactly.
And that piece gets missed. I mean, I don't know what but almost all the time. when you're in those situations.
I would say 100% of the time.
Yeah, nobody ever is looking at to see, well, let me really see the case and let me see what I can prove against you.
Unless you point it out to them.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's just being able to slow that process down and making sure that you're informed. I mean, do you see this as something that can, I know in a lot of ways, it's maybe somebody did do something wrong for whatever reason, but we're trying to get the best possible outcome to, you know, do their time, do whatever they got to do and try to rehabilitate and move on with their lives. But at the same time, do you think that, and have you seen where this maybe is curtailing some of these, you know, potential wrongful convictions that could be coming down the pike if we hadn't really slowed things down?
It's interesting that you asked that because we're in hostile territory here in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Okay. Mm-hmm. Neighboring to Philadelphia, which I was a part of the training team that trained, you know, the several hubs in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, we have a wonderful DA, Larry Krasner. They are very progressive when it comes to that. He takes a lot of heat for error on the side of caution versus we'd lock them up and figure it out later. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, in Philadelphia, absolutely. Here in Montgomery County, our DA is intentionally trying to bankrupt the organization as a bail fund. He's intentionally forfeiting our bail. So if somebody, you know, we post bail for misses a court date, which is a failure to appear, they'll get a bench warrant. The bail, historically, you know, the defendant would come in, explain why they missed their court date. The bail would be reinstated. They'd be on their way, go back and try to make sure that they'll get there. And that's, you know, how it should go.
Mm-hmm.
As of late, the DA's office has been filing motions to revoke our bail, to forfeit the bails that we post. Even though the client, the defendant comes back in, gets back into court, satisfies their obligation to the court, literally they got a disposition, whatever their sentence was. And, you know, that technically would have the bail refunded to the organization. But with this forfeiture, we don't get that bail back. Now, what he's doing in as far as like assigning a new bail so that people are still inside or not able to get out, or maybe they have to post it themselves. But also too, because I'm just processing because we're still trying to figure out what to do with this information. What my belief is that they've finalized after they forfeited the bail, they came to an agreement, some type of plea deal, and closed that case right after that. So they didn't have to reassign a cash bail to these defendants. And so when you say, could this be an opportunity to prevent a lot of that stuff? Absolutely. But they have to want to. And like you said, Montgomery County boasts a 98% conviction rate, which isn't a lie. It's actually a 98% plea rate. They're not convicting 98% of the people. You know what I mean?
Trial.
They're pleading. No, not at trial. Absolutely not. And we've seen people, I mean, that had a homicide case, sexual assault against a minor case, we've seen them be acquitted when these things shouldn't have even been charged. So they will charge everything, even if it's not a good case. They are charging people just so they like, hey, because of how they fast-tracked this thing, they're like, okay, well, we'll see. I mean, 98% of the time, we're getting a conviction. So why not charge everything? So it goes back to, okay, the DA, the police department, you know, that makes the arrest, the DA's office to look at the information, whether or not this is something that there's enough evidence to charge this individual. And then the judges to say, okay, are you really doing your job? Have you, you know, does this exist? Does this exist? Does this exist? To be able to carry those charges over to the Court of Common Pleas. So there's so many areas that, you know, wrongful convictions could be prevented, and they're not, because of the things that you had mentioned before.
Right. And bail's a big part of that, too. I don't have the statistics off the top of my head, but there's, you know, I remember years ago, Colin Miller from the Undisclosed podcast had broken this down. This was a decade ago, but I'm sure I don't remember off the top of my head. But there's a staggering difference in the outcome at a trial between someone who was granted bail and was able to prepare their defense at home with their family and with their attorney, as opposed to someone who was not able to make bail and was forced to, you know, they're locked in jail, which you're at the mercy of. You can talk to your attorney if and when they show up and when visitation can happen with your family and when you can get phone calls out. There's a huge difference. So one thing you mentioned, and I don't think a lot of people quite understand the difference here, the difference between cash bail And, you know, when bail is set, when someone is allowed to bond out, where they pay a percentage of it, like, where can you kind of explain that distinction and how it matters?
Certainly. And I apologize. I don't have that statistic either about, you know, the disparity between being able to fight your case from home and being on the inside. But it absolutely is. And that's why we do the bail, because we want to get these people out so they can fight their cases from home. They maintain whatever employment, their families, their housing, this benefits, whatever. And so here in Montgomery County, it varies in every county. So in Montgomery County, they still exercise all the different types of bail. So ROR is the lowest form. You literally sign your name, release on your own recognizance. I'm going to show up to court. No money, no cash, no percentage, no monetary association whatsoever. Then the next level is unsecured bail. So there might be a dollar amount. So let's say you get $1,000 unsecured, you still sign yourself out. But if I miss a court date, I could be responsible to pay $1,000 if I want to stay out of jail. Mm-hmm. So that's unsecured. Then you've got secured bail, which or cash bail, which is that actual dollar amount. So they just might assign you $1,000 cash and you have to pay $1,000 cash for your freedom. And then there's the 10%, which is, okay, $1,000, 10%. I have to post $100. To, you know, get my freedom, but I'm also on the hook. If I don't make my court dates, I could have to, they may want $1,000 for me to secure my freedom in the future. So
now
really,
does that distinction is that, so like the way it works here in the county where I'm at in Michigan is they set the bail amount and then you would go to a bail bondsman who you pay them 10%, which you forfeit. So if it's $1,000, you give them a hundred and that money's gone. And then they front the $1,000 for you. Does the cash bail requirement in Montgomery County, where you're at, does that make it so that a bail bondsman can't intervene in that way?
You don't have to use the bail bonds. If you've got the cash, then you can pay it directly to the court. Now, there's a lot of, you know, that their bails are significantly higher. That, yeah, you have to use a bail bonds unless you got the cash. If you got the cash, you don't have to use a bail bonds.
But you can't. So if they set, I guess what I'm asking, I'm not sure I'm articulating it clearly. Is so if they say it's a $10,000 cash bail, could you go to a bail bondsman and pay $1,000, even if they said it is cash bail, and pay $1,000 to a bondsman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you could. Yes, you
so
could.
You can still do that, but you still have to come up with that 10%.
You got to come up with that 10%. And like you said, which a lot of people don't realize, is you don't get that back. So if the 10%, and this is where it's helpful for people to understand the difference, is that if the court gives you a 10%, please pay the 10% because you get that back. If you give that 10% to the bail bonds, you don't get it back. So you're losing your money. And I had a woman, we were in court and this was a Nebbia hearing. So they were thinking that, you know, this guy's bail money was coming from his illegal activities. And the girlfriend was literally like giving her paychecks to a bail bondsman. And the bail, I think, was like $1,000. She had given the bail bondsman $700. And I'm like, why are you paying the bail bondsman the exact amount of the bail? Like, make that make sense. Like, you're not going to get that back. She's like, oh, it's okay. I'm like, bitch, I don't think you understand what's going on here. Like, you're not going to get that money back. You could have easily just paid that to the court.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't understand. And again, people are fast talking and just giving you half truth. And it's like, you're not understanding. And it's a big trust factor. And when, you know, we're not industry professionals, right? We're not attorneys. We're not even a bail fund. We're not under the regulations of a bail bond. So we're not regulated by that system. We're directly impacted people. We may or may not have any legal, you know, experience or formal education, right? So the trust factor with families to trust us versus trust their attorney or trust the bail bonds with people that have been doing this for decades. And it's like, they're taking advantage of you. They're not necessarily telling you everything that you need to know so that you can make an informed decision. They're relying on your anxiety to be like, I need my loved one home. He's the breadwinner or she's the breadwinner. She's my caretaker and I'm going to get you out. That's all they care about. They don't care about, okay, I'll give you $1,000. I'm like, yeah, you can give the court $1,000 and you'll get $900 back when your case is over. Like, make that make sense. And so
I think it's important just to, and I know my audience knows this, but I think it's always worth repeating, is that you understand the people in this situation are still innocent. They have not been proven guilty of a crime. And if they're denied bail or they're assigned a bail that they can't afford, even if they go through, so say they can't afford the bail, they fight it out and they win and they're acquitted at trial. And then 9 months later, they go home. Their family's broke. Their job is gone. You know, that system will break you. Besides, there's two pieces of it. There's two very important pieces. One is that it's so difficult to defend yourself when you're locked away.
Absolutely.
But then the other piece is, even if you have a positive outcome in court, it's still devastating. And I think even, in my situation, I'm pretty stable financially. But if I had, if my family had to go 6 months to a year of me not working because I was locked away, it would be, we would lose our house. We would lose everything.
Absolutely. And not to mention that they're trying to defend you. So the cost of defending your case, the cost of supporting you while you're inside, right? Because you'll starve if you don't have any outside support. You won't have, you get one phone call, 1 5-minute free phone call a week. Like, you know what I mean? The devastation that happens from even just 2 weeks of incarceration is astronomical and has a very long term impact on families and communities. And that's why the bail piece is so important. And I thank you for bringing that up, because if people are home, then they can maintain their housing, they can maintain their families, they can do all of the things. I got stories for days. So if you want to hear a story, I got a story to tell you. We posted a bail for a very ill person. He wasn't even homeless, but he was in supportive housing. He had a colostomy bag. His mother found her way to us. We posted his bail, and I don't remember off the top of my head. It couldn't have been more. He had two cases. So one might have been $500. So I remember getting the bail back. It was like $600. So one was $500. One was $100. And she's calling me. He's calling me, telling me, like, they don't have the medical resources to take care of this man. So his bag is coming detached daily throughout the day. He's got a celly. Now, this is just not a healthy situation for anyone. And so we finally were able to get him free. Now, mind you, this is a case we're talking probably loitering. Maybe he had a small possession of some sort. This is a very ill person. He got out, went back to his housing sources. And a month later, he was dead. And so he would have died in prison if we did not post his bail. And the only way that we found out was that he had a court date coming up. And I reached out to his mom. Hey, where's your son? We just want to make sure if he needs any support to get to court. We just want to make sure that he's successful, blah, blah, blah. And she shared that he had passed. And it was like, wow, this is crazy. Like, he should not. He was so sick. That this should not, okay, you can charge him with whatever you want, but to incarcerate him knowing you do not have the medical capacity to make sure that he survives his incarceration because of his medical condition, that's something that could have been avoided.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we deal with that. So when our DA and the community say, oh, you're freeing criminals and stuff, and it's like, this dude was trying to survive. Maybe he fell asleep somewhere because he's ill. You know what I mean? He got into an argument with somebody that owed him $5, or they were supposed to share something. And you know, it became into an argument where somebody's, oh, there's these homeless people, like whoever, whatever the case may be. But once you saw his condition, and I'll talk about court watching. So don't let me forget, we make sure that we talk about court watching and throughout. But this could have been avoided. They could have said, you know what, in lieu of incarceration, you could have put an ankle monitor on this man if you were so concerned, if he was such a threat to the community. You could have not assigned him cash bail, and he wasn't homeless, so you know where he was going to be. So it was not necessary to incarcerate this man for the crimes that he had committed, allegedly, right? It could have been avoided if our DAs and our system was looking at it from that perspective, and they don't. And so when I mentioned court watching, we weren't heavy court watching at the time when we had posted his bail. But we do have court watchers watching these preliminary arraignments every day now, 3 times a day, 7 days a week. And we're able to observe the conditions of defendants when they come in, and they're still arraigning people. We've got people that are all, coming in off of a bender. You know what I mean? They're still intoxicated. They're having a severe mental health crisis. Like, they shouldn't, they don't have the capacity to understand what's happening to them or even communicate with their family to say, hey, this is where I'm at and come help me, you know, and this is stuff that's allowed to go on. And again, because we're in hostile territory, they don't want us watching because we call out shit like that. Like how dare, what purpose did it serve to incarcerate this man that he literally died a month later?
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Why is it always chaos when we link up?
Because nobody plans anything, bro. Good thing the Rogue's ready like that.
For real. Rain, dirt, whatever. Available all-wheel drive, 5 modes, we still outside.
And they got some kick too. That turbo?
Torque is crazy. The most in its class. It moves.
Rogue doesn't mess around. And peep the space. Merch on merch, gear, mics, all of it fits.
Load up, we out.
2026 Nissan Rogue, built for all of it.
Auto Pacific segmentation, 2026 Rogue versus latest in-market competitors in the X SUV mainstream midsize class, excluding electrical vehicles based on manufacturer websites.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Explain what court watching is. And is it something that anyone can do?
Yes.
Anywhere.
And anybody can do it anywhere. You don't need any formal training. You don't need anything. It is our constitutional right. The Sixth and the Eighth Amendments are the number one tools that we use in this work because, and I'll get them confused, the Sixth Amendment could be the one where you have the right to a speedy trial. And the Eighth Amendment is the bail conditions and being able, these are public processes, right? So the public has a right. And I always challenge the public, it's our right, but it should be our duty to observe these court processes because they've operated in a silo in the justice system. We just kind of take for granted that just because it says as just in the name means that it's honorable and truthful and just and fair and unbiased and compassionate, even when it's not. This is has become a rogue system that violated the trust of the people because now they're operating, these judges are operating in silos and they have their own environment on how they interpret the law, how they execute the law, how they use their own discretion on when they will and when they don't follow the letter of the law and say, it's close enough, and they'll let it fly or they'll kick it up to the higher court because they don't want to be held responsible if something, you know, goes wrong. So yeah, it's a tool that, again, under participatory defense. So with our organization, if you want to be a court watcher with us, there is some training because we do collect data. But as a citizen, you have the right to go to any courthouse, any courtroom, sit and observe in different communities and jurisdictions like juvenile justice, family court. Those may be closed, but you would have to kind of check and see. But absolutely, it's so that you have an understanding, an unbiased understanding, because you see it for yourself. Like these stories I tell you, it's because I was there. It's not secondhand. It's like directly. I saw this for my own, with my own two eyes, my ears, everything. I witnessed it. And that, I think, when we see the police brutality and just the conviction with Carmelo Anthony, like that stuff is like, how, you know, if you were there as a court watcher watching this stuff, we document it and you can see how it happened. You know what I mean? From the back end, we're just seeing, oh, he was convicted. You know, the jury, they must have did something. He must have did something. You know what I mean? It must have been a thing. And it's like, but when you sit there and you hear the evidence and you see them present their case, you see how the DA, you know, deals with, you know, the defendant and how the judge, you know, allows certain objections or doesn't allow certain objections. And you see that maybe, I mean, my understanding, he had a great defense attorney, but then you see my son's defense attorney, in fact, he, out of a 3-day trial, he may have objected 3 times. And that was in the very beginning, not when we got into the meat of the testimony. And it's like, okay, well, what is this attorney doing? And my son's attorney did not acknowledge or didn't accept any of the recommendations or suggestions that we made, even going through the discovery as saying, hey, this, and this. He did not want our help. And that's the other thing, is that we do find that defense attorneys and system actors don't want our help because it makes them do their job. It throws them off their script, right? So now they have to adopt and try to learn a new script, which they don't want to do.
Right. And it seems like anybody working within the system, in my experience, generally, they don't want anybody interfering from outside the system. They don't like outsiders.
Absolutely.
And that's why I love this. It's another concept I've never thought of. So, because you're not just, if I'm understanding you right, you guys aren't just going to watch the proceedings for your clients. You're just spending time watching all the proceedings just to.
You can. We do both.
Yeah.
We audit, which is court watching. And then there's court support where we do go to court with families.
Right. And with the court watching. So what do you do with that? So you're watching all these hearings, you're watching these trials, you have people there that are collecting all this information and data. What are you doing with it afterwards?
So with the Vera Institute for Justice, their lens was more scientific research. Our lens is community organizing. How do we, because our local magisterial district judges, that's the first, you know, level of court, they're all elected and they have 6-year terms and they have to be reelected every 6 years. When I say that I have never seen or heard a debate or an explanation about any of these judges or why they should be a judge, they're former law enforcement. Like here in Montgomery County, you don't have to be an attorney to be a district judge. And so it's like, okay, so yeah. So we have some people that are very inexperienced in law, never practiced law, never read a law book, that are judges. We have former law enforcement, sheriffs, police departments, DAs that now become our judges. And what court watching does is it allows us, and now that, you know, here in Montgomery County, they've moved it to a Zoom platform because they got sued because they were sending people to jail without representation. So now it's a Zoom platform. All the arraignments are done via Zoom 3 times a day. And us as the community are able to observe and watch. But they put barriers on that too, because the Zoom link is not forward facing. I'm digressing because this shit's fucked up. It's crazy here in Montgomery County. You're like, fuck that. I'm never moving to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's all these things that they're just violating people's rights. And it's just like, come on. Like it's just, so we're able to observe. And now we can create a judge scorecard. Like we can, we have some outliers, but we can look at, okay, judge so-and-so, you know, assign cash bail 100% of the time for retail theft. Okay, what does that say to the community? Do you really still want this judge? Or how do you identify, you know, with retail theft? You know, some people like, you do the crime, you do the time. And it's like, but do you understand why they're doing the crime? If they're stealing because they have an addiction or they're trying to feed their family, then we have to understand that the judges don't take time to understand what's going on with these defendants and how they arrived there.
Well, and also at the time they're being assigned bail, it hasn't even been proven they did that.
Correct.
They've only been accused of doing that.
Exactly. Exactly. So why do I have to sit in jail, especially for retail theft? Like, why do I have to sit in jail and try to raise this money? Like I said, $2,500 cash. You know, we've seen upwards to $5,000 cash for retail theft for somebody's freedom. And again, like you said, it could be prevented. Like these are not things, there's alternatives. And so we're now introducing those alternatives. We're saying, hey, you could do something different. You don't have to do it this way. And so court watching just allows us to be able to say, hey, Judge so-and-so, this is what they do. This is our statistics. We've watched his arraignments for a year and this is how they're ruling. This is how they treat this. This is how they, you know what I mean? They've ruled, you know, had a hearing with somebody who clearly is incompetent, who clearly is still, you know, on whatever substance they were on the night before when this all happened. So those are the things that we can highlight. We have a podcast too. It's called Purely Speculation, where we say, hey, Judge so-and-so did this. This is what we saw on the arraignment yesterday. This is what we saw. And this is how they treated this. If we have high profile cases, you know what I mean? We'll say, hey, this is how they treated it. please pay attention because the high profile cases, they do. They follow that to the letter. So they do get those right. But all the people in between, they have a business to run. They have a prison to fill. They have contracts to pay. So I had a comment from a public defender say, oh, we like to keep the jail population around 800. And I'm like, why? Oh, because it's a business. It's a multi-billion dollar business. And if it's empty, if we only dealt with the 10% that we think are like the violent crimes, that's 80. If violent crimes and this and that, okay, well, you got a 1,500 bed jail and you can only put 80 people in it. It's not necessary, becomes obsolete and archaic, you know, where that money can be used for more programming, you know, mental health services, you know, substance abuse services. That money could be better used to, you know, help people instead of, you know, funding a system that destroys people.
Do you think that it would be, so my audience is probably more educated than most on a lot of things in the criminal justice system. Even with my audience, if I give them homework right now, which I'm kind of giving you guys homework right now.
Awesome.
To say, go wherever your local jurisdiction is, go spend a couple days in court watch. And do you think if they do that, even people that are pretty familiar with the system, that they would be surprised at what's actually going on in the courtroom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the one thing with the MDJ, so they each have, well, here in Montgomery County, they each have a different court date category, I'll say. So one day, Monday might be truancy court. Tuesday might be landlord tenant. Wednesday might be your preliminary hearings and or criminal court. And, you know, one day might be a sip. So you would have to call your local MDJ, find out what day. I mean, if you want to watch them all, have at it. But find out which day they're hearing, what types of hearings, what types of cases, and then go sit and observe. And they might ask, oh, but are you here for a case? No, I'm just an observer. That's all you have to say. Just watching, which is your right. You don't have to give your driver's license or anything like that. And sit and observe. And you'll see that most of the time, the police, sometimes there's not even an ADA in the room. It'll be the police. You know what I mean? That the police jurisdiction that is presenting the evidence, not an ADA. And it's like, is that legal?
Yeah.
Is that proper?
That's weird.
Yeah. And so that happens. And so you don't know that unless you're there. And so, yes, I think they would be completely surprised. Like they may understand, you know, the jargon, but they'll be completely surprised of what is in theory and what actually happens in practice.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the case with, you know, anybody that thinks they know how trials go.
Absolutely.
The first time they either, you know, observe a trial, read a trial transcript or anything, it's like, it's not like it is on TV.
Not at
all. And that's the more kind of air quote exciting part, right? The trial, all this preliminary stuff that leads up to it would be super interesting. I love the concept. I mean, before we end things, I kind of want to walk through, like, what does this process look like for what you guys do within your organization? So let's say I have an opioid addiction. I had an injury and got prescribed Oxy and now I'm addicted to it. I buy some illegally and I get popped with it. Yep. And so now I go into jail and they assign me a $5,000 cash bail while I'm awaiting trial for this opioid possession, whatever. So how does someone who's within your jurisdiction and or Racine here in Michigan or wherever they're at, right? How do they get in contact with you and what is that how do you decide who you're going to help and what does that look like?
Right. So here, I'll speak for here in Montgomery County because that process is different in every jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So here in Montgomery County, chances are you will not know about our organization unless you start talking to someone on the inside or you see my number written on the wall next to the phone. Because again, I said we're in hostile territory that the warden does not allow our materials to come inside the jail. So like all of our allies, our mental health, our substance abuse folks that go inside the jail and provide information, they take our information out. They don't even let our information get into the jail. But our number is in the jail. It does circulate, but you have to be talking about it. have to say, I'm here. I need help. I can't. I don't have anybody on that. Like you have to be vocal about what your need is. And it could be by the time you get around to that, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, 6 weeks could have gone by. And also too, with a practice is that, you know, which I'm sure your audience knows, that if you're in custody, you have to have your preliminary hearing within 21 days. right? Mm-hmm. How often do you see, if you're looking at dockets, that they get rescheduled? They get rescheduled twice, three times. So now you're talking about 3 months. I've been sitting here and I have not had my preliminary hearing yet, and I'm still on cash bail because I can't afford my freedom. That's how they get people to get their time. And that's how they get people to say, all right, I will plead to whatever. I need to get the fuck home.
Right.
And so, again, they are creating barriers for our organization to be able to help people get home so that they can maintain some status of their livelihood so that it doesn't devastate their family and then become, I don't want to say a burden, but then it becomes a community issue of how do we help this family? How do we keep this family from getting evicted, from their family members or whatever, resorting to criminal activity so that they can maintain their livelihood because their breadwinner is incarcerated? So it just goes so, it's just so crazy. But I mean, we've had stories. I mean, the one guy was in there for a summary offense. Like, how are you incarcerated? Because I guess he missed the court date for a summary. They issued a bench warrant. They picked him up, kept him for 6 months, 7 months, never told him about the bail fund until after he got out. He called us because now he needs legal help fighting suing them. But they never told him his bail was $100. And he never told him. He could have been 7 months on a bench warrant for a expired registration. Shit like that is just nuts. And they're putting barriers in the way of us being able to help people like that.
So what happens if someone does tell me about you? I see your number there by the phone and I call you and I'm like, hey, I just got locked up. They set the bail at $5,000. I can't get out. I can't feed my, I can't afford that. I can't keep food on the table for my family. What do you guys do when you get that phone call?
Absolutely. So we are an official nonprofit. So one of the things is that we have a database. So there's a national bail fund network, just like there's a national participatory defense network. Google bail fund network. It'll come up, Community Justice Exchange. And you can search bail funds across the country. And so through their support, they created an app that we can have. So I will refer them. I'll find out if they've got a loved one on the outside, because it's easier to communicate with the loved one on the outside than it is with the person on the inside. Mm-hmm. So we try to get them to get us connected with a loved one. If they can give us a phone number, I'll call them, have them fill out the form, because if you call on me, I'll forget. Right. And so we have them fill out the request form. Again, our cap is $5,000. And our board, when we were creating this nonprofit and the guidelines, I'm the practitioner. We do have some directly impacted folks on our board. We do have some attorneys. But I had to explain to them the methodology and the philosophy of why we're doing this. This is an oppressive system. It's not about guilt or innocence or the types of charges. So we decided we're going to go with a dollar amount versus, because, I mean, I can threaten you and I get charged with assault, right? I never even laid a hand on you. We're not even in the same state, right? And I can be charged with simple assault, never touch. So violent crimes and things like that. So we wanted to stay away from that. And so if your bail is $5,000 cash or less, you know, that's okay. Hurdle number one. You know, then we look at, do you have open cases in other counties, or do you have multiple cases in this county? So we look at, you know, what's kind of going on. I will call the jail and see, you know, do they have any outstanding warrants? It's just a vetting process. And if we have the resources, you know what I mean? Like I said, the DA is trying to bankrupt our organization. So we have to see, okay, if we've got a 2,500, 10%, okay, not a problem. We can do that versus, oh, we got a $5,000 cash. Then we have to kind of really weigh the resources versus, you know, trying to get this person free and talking with the family, you know, trying to ensure that they'll show up to court and things like that, just because we know that the DA is going to be very intentional about forfeiting our bails. So we want to be able to help as many people. So we're trying to also provide as much support so that they're successful and they can get whatever support that they need. So that's essentially the process. It does not matter how many, I mean, it does matter if we've posted bail for this individual multiple times, we'll take that into consideration, but that's rare. We have not had that often. I would say less than, I can count on one hand the number of times we've had that happen. So yeah, it's very, very simple process. It's not, you don't have to plead your case or anything like that. Is if you're in our income eligible guidelines are the bail amount. And, you know, some of those other things that I mentioned are not an issue, then yeah, we'll post the bail.
And so maybe it's beyond where you can post the bail. where does the participatory defense piece of that come in?
Absolutely.
So if you can't, if you don't, if you're like, look, I'm sorry, we don't have the $5,000 right now to post for you.
Mm-hmm. But we have these meetings on Monday night.
Okay, so explain that. Yeah. So how do you help there?
So every Monday night. So one of the other things with participatory defense, if you want to become a hub, is that you have the same bet channel, same bet time, same bet location every week. So we meet every Monday. And it's not like, oh, you got to do every other. Because like, if I don't know what week you're on, how do I need it now. So we make it very, very easy. Contrary to what the systems and all these other systems do, we make it very easy for people to find us and know we are here every Monday night from 6 to 8. If you have a case, you're not sure, you have whatever it is. And sometimes we get cases that are like juvenile or custody or whatever. We all have some type of experience. We will help you as best as we can or get you to the people that can. But yeah, every Monday night, 6 to 8, we have a hybrid model. So we do have, I'm in my office right now. So we do have a physical location that people can come to, or they can hop on via Zoom. And that's by request, you know, only. We don't make it public because there's some infiltrators and people that want to disrupt, you know, the work that we're doing and try to sabotage it and, you know, all this and that. And so we protect the movement for sure. It's not something, but we're talking to families and we vet them and we'll send them the link if they want to hop on via Zoom. And try to make it, we'll help them create email addresses and teach them how to get on Zoom. You know, if that's because a lot of times we're talking with elderly people, you know, grandmoms and, you know, aunties and things like that, that are, you know, standing in the gap for their loved ones. So there's a, you know, we try to remove as many barriers as possible.
Great. So the last question is, what can people that are listening to this, if they want to get involved, they want to help, what do they do? What are the best ways they can help?
So, for our organization specifically, bailfundmonco.org, we have all of the resources on there. Talks about participatory defense, gives you links to participatorydefense.org, which is the national that you will see where there are hubs across the country. We're actively training hubs, you know, daily across the country. Same with the Bail Fund. You know, if you're in another state and you need bail resources, Bail Fund Network, Google Bail Fund Network and it'll pop up. But also that's on our website. But also, if you go to our website, like I said, we need support. We're in hostile territory. Our funds are being depleted. Our grant writing, I'm a grant writer by trade, and I think I'm pretty good at it. We were doing really well. But now all of a sudden, you know, we're making an impact and we're interrupting and we're, you know, we've gained the attention of the DA here and he doesn't like it. So, you know, and it's very political, right? It's very political. Yeah. The judges don't like it because now we're watching you and you're like, why are you watching me? You're not supposed to be. How dare you? Is the attitude.
You're right.
How dare you? How dare you? Yeah. And it's like, this is our constitutional right. They ask us, when are you going to stop doing this? Never. This is our constitutional right. You know? And so, yeah, we're an official nonprofit. So all proceeds that are donated or whatever are tax deductible. And yeah, we just need more people. Even you can support us by doing this work in your community, doing the court watching. Let it not just be your right. Let it be your duty. Jury duty. We didn't talk about that. Like when you're jury of your peers, like, you know, people aren't getting called for jury duty. And how do we impact that? And there's just so many layers to it. And folks can, you know, engage however they comfortable, whatever their schedule allows. But if you're in a different state or a different community, find out what you can do in that community and then get connected with us and we can support you and find other people and get a hub together or whatever we need to do so that, you know, that city can be protected.
That's excellent. And last thing you mentioned earlier, I just want to state it again. You said you guys have a podcast where you talk about some of the stuff. What is that called again?
Yes, it's called Purely Speculation. We have a YouTube channel. I think the YouTube channel is Reuniting Family Bail Fund, but the podcast is under that. And great. You'll see episodes on our website as well.
Awesome. So check that out. Get involved. Go to their website. And Heather, it's been great meeting you. And thanks so much for all the work that you're doing. It's been a real pleasure.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.